Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Welcome, dear listeners. Today, I would like to directly start with two questions. First, did you know that many common diseases are linked to an overactive innate immune system? And secondly, did you know that chronic inflammation does play a significant role in the development of most non-communicable diseases such as cancer, diabetes, rheumatism, and also neurological disorders? If that caught your interest, you're absolutely in the right place. And thanks for tuning in to a new episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. Today, we are honored to have a renowned scientist in immunology and rheumatology with us. So please give me a warm welcome to Professor Dr. Eike Latz. Eike is a distinguished physician and immunologist who has made substantial contributions to this field. Since May 23, he serves as the Professor of Experimental Rheumatology at the Charité Hospital and the Scientific Director of the German Rheumatism Research Center in Berlin. His research focuses on how the innate immune system maintains health and under what circumstances it can promote even diseases. Specifically, he studies the molecular mechanisms that activate or inhibit the immune system and how these processes influence inflammation across various diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, atherosclerosis, and also Alzheimer's. Early on, Eike began his medical education at the Georg August University in Göttingen and continued at the Freie University in Berlin. His career started as an intensive care physician at the Charité in Berlin, and in 21, he relocated to the US for his postdoctoral research at the Boston University and later held his first professorship at the UMass Jahn Medical School. He returned then to Germany back in 2010 to establish the Institute for Innate Immunity at the University Hospital Bonn. Throughout his career, Eike has co-founded 9 biotech companies that translate his research into novel therapeutic and preventative approaches. Together with selected industry partners, he is working ambitiously on ensuring that his findings lead to new drugs and therapies in the near future. With over 300 publications, Eike is also a highly cited scientist in immunology and has received numerous prestigious awards, including the Leibniz Prize back in 2018, which is regarded as one of Germany's most significant research honors. On top of that, Eike is currently building a cutting-edge innovation hub that is dedicated to personalized medicine and prevention. And this initiative is designed to function as a future-forward hospital that is seamlessly integrating with the highly innovative Charité Healthcare ecosystem and beyond. I'm thrilled to have him on our podcast today, and I truly look forward to a very insightful discussion and exchange on the current research in inflammatory and rheumatological diseases. So thanks again for joining us here in sunny Berlin today, Eike.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So you really have a very diverse and impressive career path, moving initially from intensive care medicine to a leading role in immunology and rheumatology. Can you share with us what actually motivated to also shift your focus gradually over time from a clinical practice into research, and how that transition has probably also shaped your perspective on healthcare as a whole?
So as a young physician, I actually, as you mentioned, was working in an intensive care unit here at the Charité. And as you know, those patients that you treat, they are fairly sick. Most of them are intubated. They receive medication to keep the blood pressure up. And the issue is that even though you have these sick people, we don't really understand what the cause of the sickness is. And you basically provide life care. So keep people alive, treat the symptoms, but not really the origin of the problem. Mm. And that was a rather frustrating experience, especially because I also worked on the site in the laboratory of molecular sepsis research. We're trying to understand how is sepsis happening, mm-hmm. and what's the background. And so I was divided between, you know, understanding mechanisms and then treating patients where we don't really treat the mechanisms, but the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And that got quite frustrating. So at some point, there was a discovery that was published. There was the first innate immune signaling receptor called TLR4 or toll-like mm-hmm. receptor 4. And I thought this is probably opening a new field of research, and not just research, but also a new field of translation, new field of medicine. So I made the conscious decision to basically leave medicine and then applied for a job in Boston and mm-hmm. Left for a postdoctoral fellow.
And that's probably also a good lead over, as obviously your journey not only took place in Germany, but also the US, and also you came back after your stint in the US. So you must have experienced also their different cultural, but also academic environments. Curious to learn where the differences are and also what made them shape you up who you are today.
Well, I guess I profited a lot from both scientific areas or research environments. So as you mentioned, I moved in about 2000 to Boston, moved into an area that was really new. So there mm-hmm. was not much known about the molecular mechanisms of innate immunity. And so immediately lots of labs popped up and started to work on this new topic. And we were collaborating with a lot of different labs from Harvard, Boston University, UMass, many of these universities mm-hmm. in Boston area. So that was exciting to be part of this discovery phase. At the same time, Boston at that time was developed into a real biotech and pharma hub. Mm-hmm. So the city changed a lot. Lots of buildings popped up for lab space. Companies moved into Boston, very much to the center, Boston and Cambridge. So there was a vivid exchange between scientists and pharma people, mm-hmm. scientists from pharma companies that bring their own perspectives. So I was immediately asked, because we were at the forefront of discovering new receptors, new potential drug targets, to give advice to many of these companies. And for a young scientist, this was really great. And I had a lot of fun doing this. And actually, I learned a lot about how pharma scientists work and how they think and what their priorities are, which are sometimes different to what you do in the lab. So it was almost like we learned from each other, I would say. And that was a very interesting time, because the science was kickstarted by this new, discovery. But at the same time, the area of Boston was kickstarted to be the hub for translation. So I mm-hmm. think I could learn a lot of how the folks in this area think about translation, how discoveries are not just discoveries that are published, but discoveries that can lead to new medicines. And that was a fun area.
And that must have also helped you and gave some trigger points, I assume, to co-found your 9 biotech companies that I find very, very admirable. What actually inspired you to take that entrepreneurial role in addition to your obviously day-filling academic work that you did at the time? And how have you used those experiences in founding companies and going about that? And probably also linked with that, and you meant that before as well, what is actually the relationship that you took from there, from a scientific discovery perspective versus also clinical, practical application of science? Because that is not always in sync.
Yeah. Yeah, so I left medicine for a reason. So I wanted to understand how diseases are triggered on a molecular level. So I always had my patients in mind that were lying there in the intensive care unit and being treated symptomatically, and we're trying to keep them alive, but we didn't really do anything for the mechanism of why they're sick. So that was this dilemma that I always had. And maybe also was a driver to find something new mm-hmm. that could lead to new therapies. We're not there yet, especially sure. In sepsis, because it's a very complicated process. But immunology at large has contributed to many new therapies that are very, very effective these days. Think about anti-cytokine therapies, and we have more than glucocorticoids these days, yep. right? But so that was always the driver, my experience as a physician in the clinical setting. And by the way, I also worked in Africa for some time. So that was another experience. But the translation was so close then. You found these new receptors that we thought are important for driving inflammation in certain settings. And then in the Boston area, we had all this translational spirit anyways, and all these pharma companies that wanted to get insights. What I also experienced after working for many years with pharma companies, that these large organizations have some deficiencies. So it takes so much time to really go through all the ranks in the hierarchy to convince people of a drug target and to convince people to really work on this fast because it's important. That I also got frustrated again because it was too slow for me. So, and then at some point I stopped all my consulting contracts. I had many of those and said, look, I'm just doing it myself. So we found it, you know, found a team of scientists and drug hunters and then started the first company.
And if you compare now Boston and the very vivid environment, I mean, I don't know, 18 out of the top 20 pharma companies must be there at least. Yeah, a lot of academic excellence, a lot of money there these days, and seed funding not being a problem at all, I assume. If you compare that Boston space versus Germany, or in specific the Berlin area where we are, what's kind of the pattern that you're seeing that is in common, or where are the big differences?
Well, you know, I think Germany has fantastic science. We spend about more than 3% of the GDP on science. So that's also seen in the world as maybe one of the top countries in the world that does basic research and basic science. So that's very good. So the science translation is a little bit of a different beast because, as you just mentioned, you need quite some risk funding for that. So this venture capital industry that is very prolific in the United States, especially in these hubs like Boston, San Francisco, but now also New York, that is not as developed here in Europe, especially not in Germany. So the conditions for funding science translations are not as good here as in these other areas. Another thing is that you also need, you know, free lab space that you can rent. If you have an idea to translate, you need lab space. So that's not so easy to get. But that's another industry in the United States where there are labs you can just go in and rent and pay some, you know, expensive rent, but at least you can do the work. So the ecosystem is more than just, you know, science. It has to be, the science translation has to be funded well. You have to have lab infrastructure, and you also have to have a certain mindset. So not every scientist thinks, oh yeah, let's translate my own ideas into a new product. But if you compare that, for example, in Boston, I'll give you an example, MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, admittedly a very, very good institution, but every fourth student makes his or her own company. So there's at the moment more than 30,000 active companies of the MIT. They employ 4.7 million people and have 2.8 trillion income. So that's the 10th biggest economy in the world.
That is super impressive.
Yeah, that's only from one university. And so this mindset that you take your discoveries and translate them is something that is, you know, very obvious in the United States.
And that means, if I get that right, it's not the science that we lag behind. Science supposedly is great also here, as we are also investing a lot into it, but it's more the infrastructure, the overall founding conditions, the risk capital available or not available that makes the difference here versus the other big hubs in overseas.
Exactly. So it's... one thing is the mindset is really important, that we have to think about our science and why we do it, and can we, in quote unquote, exploit the science to make a product? And this doesn't only apply to biotech, obviously. Yeah. But the conditions to exploit the science, they need to be made better here in Europe, especially. Because, you know, I tried the first companies, I actually tried to raise funds here in Germany. We had like a team of scientists, also pharma people, but it took ages to actually get traction. And people said, oh, way too early. This is too complicated and we're not going to do it. And then one trip to Boston, we had 30 millions and we could actually make the first product. And the first product we sold after 1 year. So it's possible to do it.
It is possible.
If the environment allows you to do it.
Yeah. we dive a bit into the research and your field of experience, the innate immune system is obviously the body's first line of defense against any pathogens like bacteria, viruses, and also fungi. Your research examines its role in various diseases, as mentioned before. Could you explain probably the main differences between the innate and the adaptive immune system and why it's actually important to also understand these distinctions for developing effective therapies?
Sure. So innate cells are mainly neutrophils, monocytes, macrophages, and dendritic cells. So cells that, you know, surveil the environment for danger signals, for microbial products. And once they find something, they're activated, and the receptors they have are so-called pattern receptors. So they sense not very specific features of bacteria, but patterns that are not found, for example, in our own body, but they're found in bacteria, or molecules that should not be outside cells and that are released during cell death. So they can sense these type of danger signals, that we, how we call them. And then once that happens, they are activated, make a lot of cytokines and chemokines, so factors that activate other immune cells. And among these other immune cells, you have then the adaptive immune system, so B cells and T cells mainly. So those cells are designed to detect very specific patterns on bacteria and viruses or funguses, for example. And also they could detect infected cells, right? So, and then once they are activated, they can proliferate. So the same cell makes copies of itself, and then you can attack that particular trigger that is found by the innate immune system with very, you know, with many cells at the same time. And it also applies to tumors, for example. So that's the main difference, but it's not very helpful to divide the innate and adaptive immune system categorically, because you basically also have pattern sensors, the same innate immune pattern sensors in some of the adaptive immune cells, like B cells, for example. They also have toll-like receptors and things like that. But even non-immune cells like stromal cells, epithelial cells, or endothelial cells, they also are equipped with these receptors. So they can sense autonomously the same features that the immune cells can sense in bacteria, for example, which is also important because every cell needs to protect themselves.
Moving on from there, I'm utterly convinced that whatever you expose your body with, this will have an effect on your body. And some researchers actually suggest that our most modern Western diets may actually negatively affect our immune system and also resilience, while others argue that a diet properly done can help treat health issues, including even cancerous and chronic immune disorders like lupus and others. Given your research on the influence of environmental factors and lifestyle on chronic inflammations and rheumatology diseases, what is your perspective on this? Would you, in which camp are you? And can you allude a bit what the influencing factors are for us?
Yeah, sure. So overall, there are several types of diets. You know, we call, for example, the not so beneficial diet Western type of diet. So the type of food we are exposed to in modern cities, fast food and these kind of things are called, is called Western diet. It's essentially a diet that is rich in cholesterol, other fats, salt, and high in sugar. So everything that makes you, you know, eat more of the diet than you should. And that's actually the most important thing. It's not really the type of diet you eat, but how much energy you take on. So if you look back into the 50s or so in Western world, where we didn't have these amounts of fast food, we had roughly half of the energy intake per day. So that's quite different. Also, there's regional differences. The United States, for example, on average, has twice the amount of energy intake than Japan. So you can imagine what happens if you do this every day. Then, I mean, you store the energy somewhere, and that leads to obesity, and that leads to, you know, follow-on diseases like type 2 diabetes. So it's, one thing is really the amount of energy. It's not so much, and it's not so important what type of diet you eat, but there are also things in diets, such as cholesterol, for example, that then can initially also trigger a disease. So if we give, for example, mice or rabbits a diet that's rich in cholesterol, which they normally don't have because they eat normally plants. Then you can induce a human disease, which is called, for example, atherosclerosis, right? So just the cholesterol in the diet is sufficient to induce that disease. And that's kind of a model system that you use. So there are also beneficial diets. So, for example, diets that are rich in fibers are thought to be beneficial. And we now understand also why that is, because fibers are, for example, digested by your gut microbes into shorter pieces of fatty acids. They're also called short-chain fatty acids. And they're really like pharmacologically active substances that have receptor counterparts. They activate certain receptors that then cause an anti-inflammatory phenotype. So I think what we have is a lot of pharmacology in the gut that's completely underexplored. Mm-hmm. And it's in the end, the gut constituents, our microbes, our microbiome, it's called, is basically determined of how you or what you eat and how you nourish yourselves.
And I mean, we're now pivoting a bit into the sphere of also preventative power, yeah, in healthcare. So if it is known that diets can do bad or good, depending on which diet you're on, still humans are humans and are sometimes not behaving as they should behave, right? So why is this that we know so much about which diets are beneficial for ourselves and which are not? Is there also a big component again of mindset of people, behavioral science needed to make people actually switch and behave? Or how do you see that? Because you're seeing a lot of patients, you're seeing a lot of patterns. There are the ones that are kind of having it easier to follow a certain diet and others not. Is there a pattern? Can we do something there?
Yeah, that's actually why we study the individual responses of people towards certain risk factors. Mm. So, because I think without data, it's very hard to make recommendations because, you know, not every diet is good for everyone and not every diet is bad for everyone. Yeah. So I think it has to be done on a personalized level. It's much easier to understand that a respiratory virus can be prevented. You prevent infection by wearing a mask, right? Because that's possible, but you have to eat every day, right?
For sure.
And the type of food you eat is defined by where you find it, you know, where you buy it. And this is a little bit of a harder thing to communicate because the food is also designed to be palatable and to be, you know, you indulge in having this food. And so it's not so easy to get this language over to people, their recommendations over. But if you do it on a personalized level where you test certain foods on individual level, and then you can say, okay, this food, you should stay away because this causes too much of a sugar spike in yourself, then this may be a different story, right? And these personalized nutrition approaches are being developed. They're actually in clinical practice in certain areas of the world, especially in the United States. And that allows you then to, you know, change the pattern a little bit based on your personalized microbiome and your personalized genetic background.
Mm-hmm. So recent advancements also in the understanding of the molecular basis of chronic inflammations and rheumatology disorders, along with improvements also in the diagnostics, imaging and drug therapy, many are saying that it has the potential to redraw the map of diseases. And also you in a recent interview mentioned that these developments could actually lead to what you call a revolution in medicine. Could you probably elaborate a bit on how that precision immunodiagnostics could help us transform the approach in how we classify, but also how we treat certain diseases?
Sure. So what we have at the moment is, I mean, we've learned a lot from immunology from the past 20 to 30 years, also for therapy. So I mentioned that there are now very potent anti-cytokine therapies. Mm. These are mostly antibodies against inflammatory cytokines. So you can actually, you know, disturb the language of the immune system to treat diseases quite effectively. That is a revolution in itself because nowadays these diseases that are in the textbooks of, you know, joints that are completely destroyed in rheumatoid arthritis or plaque psoriasis, so you have this skin inflammation that was not really responding to the treatments that was applied. They are kind of controlled in most patients by this new anti-inflammatory therapy. So this is kind of a success story of of the innate and adaptive immunity research of the last 20 to 30 years. It will become more specific in the future, because now that we have knowledge of the innate immune system, we can actually be more precise. We can be more upstream of the cytokines, for example. So we can see, okay, which is the trigger of the inflammation and what pathway is activated. And you can then target these particular pathways so that the cells can still make the cytokine if they, for example, encounter a bacterium or a virus. So you don't block that per se, but you block that just one pathway that can trigger inflammation. So that's going to be more precise in the future. We now have also developed T-cell based therapies, so so-called CAR T-cells, that were initially developed to do treatments of certain B-cell lymphomas. And these CAR T-cells are now applied also in autoimmune diseases. So that's, I think, also a fairly big revolution, because the first patients that were treated are still without symptoms. The B-cells came back, but not the pathogenic ones. But these patients are not even under treatment. So they are basically cured from the diseases, you know. So this is a field that is rapidly emerging. There's many different diseases that you can target with these B-cell depleting CAR T-cells. And there's also new approaches how you can do this by using bispecific antibodies. So you basically have one arm binding to the B-cell that you want to deplete, another arm to the T-cell that is then at the same time activated. And then you just, you know, inject an antibody, and then this will take care of your B-cells or even plasma cells. And the first success stories are also coming out with that approach.
And I want to come back in a second to the CAR T-cell therapies and where you see biggest promises there. But it's also probably important to share that approximately 5 to 8% of our global population does suffer from around 100 known autoimmune diseases. Some of these conditions are, however, so rare that most general practitioners would never see them, encounter them, while others are more common, making autoimmune diseases, by and large and in totality, the third most prevalent group of illnesses after cardiovascular events, of course, and cancers. So the reason why the immune systems of these patients mistakenly attack their own organs, tissues, or cells remain still somewhat poorly understood, I would say, way more advanced than in the past, though. And although those treatments exist that can temporarily suppress the immune system response and alleviate symptoms, a permanent solution is lacking. And you alluded already through the CAR T-cell therapies, and this is probably also something where the Charité Hospital is very actively looking into and investing into, from what we're seeing. Can you share a bit, because you alluded already to those parts, what and where are the biggest promises of that? What are the diseases that would most immediately and most prominent benefit from it?
Sure. So maybe a little bit of history here. So the first CAR T cells were applied in autoimmune diseases by a German scientist and physician, Georg Schett, in a group in Erlangen. So he's a rheumatologist and applied these CAR T cells against B cells and essentially cured the first few patients. That was now also translated by several biotech companies. And there's now clinical trials based on these initial very promising results that are being done, I think, worldwide. Interestingly, one of the folks that was in Erlangen together with Georg Schett is Gerhard Krönke. And Gerhard Krönke is the new chair of rheumatology here at the Charité. So he's also doing a lot of different CAR T-cell approaches, not just for lupus, systemic lupus erythematosus, but they're also testing other diseases in the rheumatological diseases that are linked to B-cell overactivity. So I think this field is progressing to different indications. And the idea here is that you can potentially cure diseases rather than just, you know, treat the symptoms and suppress the disease. That's why it's so exciting. That's why there's a revolution in this area.
And the more we understand those molecular pathways, the better we can obviously target our responses to it. And I mean, I know it's always difficult to answer a question for relative knowledge to what we can know, but it's rarely that I have an immunologist and such an expert with me. If you consider there is 100% of knowledge around molecular pathways that we could gain as society. Where do we stand percentage-wise in our understanding of molecular pathways leading to autoimmune responses that we can predict or not predict?
Well, the autoimmune field is a particularly complicated one, I would say. I think we have almost exhausted the discovery of new pathways of mm-hmm. the innate and adaptive immune system, the interplay of these cells and how they communicate. We also understand, maybe not fully, but then the distribution of cells within tissues, what they recognize in the tissue, how they then communicate locally. These are areas of active research at the moment. There's also new technology out there. It's called spatial biology, mm-hmm. where you can then understand better what pathways are turned on in the site of inflammation. So in the inflamed joint or the lymph node. So these are areas of interest at the moment in the scientific discovery. But there's much to learn about these pathways, how they are triggered in different areas of inflammation. So that's not fully understood. When it comes to autoimmunity, I think there are now, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, new gain of function mutations in particular pathways. For example, the TLR7 pathways, if you have a gain of function mutation in that from birth on, then the kids develop a very similar syndrome like lupus. So very strong autoimmunity is actually lethal. Mm-hmm. There's another molecule that traffics TLR7. If there's a gain of function in that one, it's called ONC9-3B. You also have a systemic lupus. We also know that other pathways like the STING pathway can cause a syndrome that's called AGS syndrome that causes lupus-like symptoms. And so the more we understand about the upstream drivers of disease, we also find more genetic syndromes that are linked to initiation of diseases. So I think we now understand that this is not necessarily a disease that needs, I don't know, 10 factors or so, but that only one factor, one hyperactive pathway mm-hmm. can potentially lead to disease. Now it's up to us to understand what are these factors, what are these pathways, can we diagnose them? And then if we can diagnose them, then we can probably also treat them in the future.
That is a very good lead over, I assume at least, as AI has also rapidly become a very valuable, almost invaluable tool in healthcare, offering promising solutions to numerous challenges within the field of medicine. In the context of immunology and rheumatology, how do you assess the future potential of AI, especially when it comes to diagnosis, disease classification, but also treatment decision-making and optimization? And linked to that, are there already some good examples that they can reference?
Yeah, I mean, AI is particularly helpful and useful to understand very complex patterns in large data sets.
Yes.
And I think that we have in medicine many, many complex patterns that physicians learn, obviously, through their studies. But AI can be very helpful to put them together and to help the physician to be a better physician in the end. Okay, so I think it's definitely will change medicine very dramatically. Mm. Not just the way we, you know, understand diseases, but also the way we treat patients. Treatment suggestions can be recommended by a pattern analysis by the AI. It will never replace physicians, but it will definitely aid physicians to do a better job in the end. So now when it comes to data sets, so what we are doing in terms of, for example, analysis of blood is relatively small and minimal. Mm-hmm. And that has to do that with, you know, the way we take blood from patients and how we ship it around and what you can actually measure with this. So for example, if you take blood and leave it outside at different temperatures, and then you ship it to the laboratory. Many cells have died. Many cells have potentially been activated. So understanding more of what happens in the patients mm-hmm. Is complicated because you have all these these factors that are released by the shipping and the handling of the material. So that has to be done completely in a different way. So we have to set up biopsy units where the patient's coming in, the blood is taken and immediately processed so that you can actually get more complicated assays done on this material. Same is true for biopsies, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, you can nowadays apply much more complicated algorithms on biopsies, on the tissue samples that you can take from patients. So, and all these so-called multi-omics approaches, AI will be very helpful to understand the patterns and relate these patterns back to the symptoms of the patient. It's always very important that you also acquire the symptoms in a machine learnable way, that you can actually relate a certain pattern to a certain symptom. And that will take out a little bit of the voodoo of science in the end, because if you make causal relationships between a pattern or a particular pathway that's activated, and then the inflammation process, and then the symptom that appears after the inflammation causes symptoms, which typically is already some damage that has been caused, then these causal relationships are really important to explore, and I think AI will help in that quest.
And it's interesting that you also mentioned with AI some basic elements such as taking blood samples from patients and letting them lay around for 15 minutes before shipping them over at room temperature, and I don't know, 50% whatever percentage of biopsy not really trustable anymore or measurable anymore, because things happen in those 15 minutes at room temperature. So the also getting the basics right will enable the AI at some point to make those causal relationships, right? Because if we're not able to measure appropriately, we're not having the data that we can read into.
Yeah, correctly. So you have too many artifacts if you don't fix what we call the pre-analytics. Yeah. So if you do the pre-analytics, meaning the processing from sampling the patient to bring it into the tube, if you do this always the same, there's not so much error that will lead to misinterpretations of the data. So, and our idea is that we want to get away from the phenotypic description of diseases that are basically symptom-driven to more a molecular description of diseases, because only if you have a molecular description, you can apply very specific molecules that target these very specific molecular pathways that cause disease. So this is kind of a catch-22. If we stay with a phenotypic description, you know, we look at the damage that the disease mechanism has already made, then we are not going to apply the more specific drugs that are being developed due to the research of the last 20 years.
And as healthcare changes, there is also a shift towards providing care outside of traditional hospital settings that we are used to, using also a mix of connected physical locations with virtual services. This approach then obviously also allows for care to be delivered more in communities, in home care settings, or even various facilities based on what doctors recommend and what patients prefer. Given your work on creating a future hospital, what role do you see for those hospitals in prioritizing preventative care also going forward?
So hospitals of the future, I think, will provide more holistic approaches, not just providing care for the sick, but we also have to provide care for people that are potentially getting sick in the future. So we need to understand pre-disease states that are not yet, you know, leading to symptoms of a disease, but you can also already measure them. So I think in the future, hospitals will have to be more engaged in, you know, diagnostics. Mm-hmm. So very deep phenotyping of disease states and pre-disease states, because that allows you to then also provide, you know, care much, much earlier than you would do now. So that's and that needs to be done on a personalized level, because not everyone will have the same risk profile. And coming to risk, this is also very important. We know many risk factors that lead to diseases, but they are not assessed on a personalized level. Mm. So if you think about a city, we know that a lot of people, more than half of the population on the earth, lives in cities, and cities are not particularly healthy places because you have pollution, you have noise, you have humidity and heat, and you can sometimes not escape this. If you go to work, you bike on the streets and have a lot of pollution that you inhale. So, but there's now ways to quantify these risk factors on a personalized level. And if you do that, and you can then link that to the immune system, how that's activated by these risk factors, and that is then linked to the disease process, you have a more holistic understanding of how people are getting sick, and you can make recommendations based on that on a personalized level. So I think it's important to not just track the environmental risk factors, but obviously also the lifestyle risk factors, which can be done with all kinds of wearable devices these days. If you look at an Apple Watch, for example, the amount of data that is gathered by this device on your own health is quite amazing. And you can also use that to analyze your own risk. And then there's also genetic risk factors. So I think we are not screening enough in that respect, because many diseases that are out there are also linked to certain genetics, so SNPs in certain areas. So that's why I think we need to test also the immune function. And so functional assays can provide you with novel information of why certain people have higher risk to develop disease than others, because their genetic makeup and their epigenetic makeup can be different, and therefore they respond more to environmental triggers, for example, to microbial triggers. And that can be assessed as well in the lab. But it has to be done, again, in a very methodological way and with robots and without influence of, you know, other factors.
And hearing that, obviously, also lets me think that obviously healthcare is getting more and more complex, and through the preventative side to care. It's not the doctor classically that we used to know and what we studied, both of us and others, but it's merely somebody who, yes, understands diseases and how to go about it and treat them, but also understanding proper sporting, healthy eating and dietary and the alike. So being more a health coach than a doctor going forward. That merits a couple of thoughts. Yeah? First one is, obviously, is our curriculum catering for that? Yeah. And recently I've been talking to Professor Jochen Werner from the University Hospital of Essen, and he's going to retire, and he was sharing that his studies more or less are very similar to the studies that his daughter nowadays is undergoing, also studying medicine. So number one, curriculum, what to adapt. And secondly, I'm 100% certain these type of connections and patterns that you can read into a patient, this cannot come from a single source doctor or health coach, right? So this person needs to be much more supported through underlying trusted analytics and insights that are shared with the doctor. Can you share your perspectives on those two elements, pattern recognition, analytics supporting, plus the curriculum?
Yeah, you're touching a really good point here, because in the end, medicine is preparing physicians to detect symptoms, right? And then the disease is based on a number of symptoms, and that's actually what you learn. And you learn algorithms, how to treat a disease. So since 200 years, you go to the doctor when you're sick, you don't necessarily go to the doctor when you're not sick. Yeah. You know, there are prevention approaches, you know, in certain cancers and cardiovascular disease, but by and large, it's mainly a repair medicine nowadays. And that is also reflected by the training of our physicians. And I remember when I was a physician, prevention was not really a major focus, because you're seeing sick people, right? You're not seeing healthy people necessarily. So what we actually need is, we need collaboration across various disciplines. As I mentioned, environmental sciences, data sciences, very important, and medicine need to collaborate to really fix this issue, right? And if you think about the medical students of today, they will come in a world in five to 10 years where medicine has evolved and there's a lot of data science that is required. So why are physicians, or let's say you know, trainees are not learning more data science mm-hmm. these days. I think that's lacking in the curricula. So in the end, the AI revolution will affect many areas, including medicine. And if you don't prepare yourself for this, then it's hard to catch up and hard to understand these things, I think.
So now, fast forwarding from here, as you are a forward thinker, an actor, actually, 5 to 7 years from now, what's your prediction or even a bit of hope to be the next frontier in immunology and inflammation research? What have we seen as big leaps, hopefully, in that time frame?
Well, I think AI has the capacity to understand not just our own language. So like words in a row lead to a sentence and that can be predicted. But AI also has the capacity to understand the language of biology, the language of immune system, the language of how disease-driving factors causes the activation of a certain pathway. What's the hierarchy in the pathway from the trigger to the kinase that is activated to the transcription factor that's activated to the gene that is induced? So these are all hierarchies that are just like sentences, right? So you can learn that if you have enough data, if you provide the data to the right algorithm. So I think that offers a huge opportunity to make models of cells, for example, you know, virtual cells. And then this would also allow, if you understand the complex signaling pathways in different immune cells, that allows you then to do virtual screens. So you can say, okay, here's my model of the immune system. What happens if I take factor X out, the newly discovered factor X? How would the cell respond, right? So that can be done on the basis of a learned system that reflects the language of an immune system or immune cell in that respect. So there's a lot of interesting developments in this area, and this will affect not just the science, but also drug discovery, drug development, but in the end also patient selection. Because if you apply these algorithms then to material that you get from a sick patient where these pathways are turned on naturally because of the disease process, you may find by comparing that to experimental evidence which pathway is actually active in that patient at the time of the analysis. And then nowadays, for example, if you go to a physician with rheumatoid arthritis, it's an empiric process. Mm-hmm. You get a very potent drug, for example, anti-TNF therapy, but not everyone responds. So then after 3 months, you come back, attest it again. If you don't respond, then you're a so-called non-responder, you can get the next drug. So wouldn't it be nice to learn from the people that don't respond, or for those that respond, why they respond or why they don't respond? So this is not really
would
done.
Would be logical, yeah.
Would be logical, but this requires deep analysis, deep phenotyping yeah. of the immune system to see, okay, what are the pathways that allow this particular patient to respond or that prevent them from responding? So that's kind of the next frontier, I think, in science.
So big thanks, Eike, once again. I very much liked the excursion that you allowed us to follow you along some molecular pathways, showing also how complex medicine and humans are, and also alluding to how AI can probably help decomplex this. But also the concrete examples where initial success was proven. But also thanks a lot for giving some hints around which factors are actually super important for making a biotech hub an excellence hub, yeah, along the lines of education, infrastructure, funding conditions and the like. So big thanks for sharing this. Highly appreciate that.
Well, sure, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for joining today and listening into yet another episode. Feel free to reach out through LinkedIn or our website to continue the dialogue, or also share your feedback. Stay tuned for our next episode. It will be equally interesting, I can promise. And until then, take care and bye-bye.
Strategy and Strategy made real.